This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2022, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders Educational Programs on March 24 and 25, 2022, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's an honor to be here and to I didn't know what to expect, really. This is my first time I was ever at Reach, and I wasn't sure how many people would even be interested in this topic. So I don't know, maybe you're all here because the other ones were full. We're going to go with it anyway. There's so much to cover. We're just going to zero in on a few things and the whole thing of trauma and anxiety and OCD and scrupulosity. So trauma, it can cause many different issues. And anxiety and OCD and scrupulosity is just kind of one piece of the shattered glass that it can cause. So I'm going to try to stay in that and focus on that, and I might tend to get carried away on other things, but it's not my goal. But as the moderator said, I'm a husband and a wife, not a wife, but my wife Marilyn here, and six children. Our one child is not biological. She comes from a traumatic, hard background, so we have a lot of experience with a child that has experienced trauma as well. Mental health is a very complex thing, and I by no means want to tell you all that I know how to fix trauma, but I would like this to be a time where we could think together about this and see if we can better understand ourselves and others. So if it's one thing I want to do, if there's one thing I do not want to do,
that's not amplifying you, that's just recording.
Oh, okay. Is give you the impression that I know everything about this, because it is a huge, complex, mental health is just so complex. It's one reason I love it, because you can never get to the point where there's nothing more to learn. I mean, there's always something new. There's always a new person. Every story's different. And it's just mind-blowing. The privilege I have to sit with people that I've never met before. I work with very few Anabaptist people, but people from the city that have never even met me, and they sit down and before you know it, they're like, "Can't believe I'm telling you this. I've never told anybody this in my whole life." And they're 40 years old, and the thrill of being able to help somebody, it's just amazing. So anyway, moving to our topic, the word trauma, I think, is becoming very popular, and I'm not sure if it's totally a good thing or not, but, it's kind of like a buzzword. I think it's getting to be kind of like addiction. People think they're addicted to coffee, and they're addicted to work, and they're addicted to food, and it's kind of it makes light of what true addiction really is, because true addiction is just a horrible thing. It's the same way with trauma. There's people that have been horrendously traumatized, and then there's others of us that have experienced some effects of trauma, but on a scale of 1 to 10, ours might only come in at 2 or 3 or something. So I don't want to make light of the significance of suffering that some people have went through. One of my clients came to me, he actually took his own life later, he had an appointment with me that he wasn't able to keep because he took his life, but he was run over 3 times by a pettibone on a construction site, and the driver claims he thought he was backing up against a curb, and he thankfully he didn't get above his torso, but from here down he was crushed and rebuilt, and it was in the hospital 18 months and addicted to painkillers and all kinds of things. His level of trauma was significant. Anyway, I want to start off by reading a story give you a little impact of trauma. This is a story found in the book Rare Leadership, written by Jim Wilder. He says, as a young man, I spent a summer working at a camp that often saw people from the inner city of Chicago come to the country to gain a different perspective on life. This was not explicitly a Christian camp. One inner city group that came there was composed entirely of senior citizens. What happened that week taught me a life lesson about emotional maturity and the biblical idea of loving kindness. One older lady came to my attention when we took the campers for meals. It was a practice at this camp to have two lines at mealtime. Those seniors who needed a walker to get around got the short line by the door. Everyone else was in the other line. Our first meal of the week, the lady I noticed rushed ahead, knocking over people with walkers until she reached the front of the line where she pushed at the door. I reprimanded her. She could obviously walk fine and should be in the other line. But it was as though I and my words to her did not exist. She stared ahead, demanding food, and rushed through the door the second the staff opened the lunch line. The surprised staff jumped out of the way while she grabbed food and devoured it before anyone else could eat. This happened at every meal, and the only way to manage the situation was for counselors to form a human shield in front of the walker brigade before she could knock them over. To make matters worse, this lady stunk and could be smelled for quite a distance. She absolutely refused to take a shower. Within a few days, the female counselors could take the stench no longer. So a group of them forcibly dragged her into one of the shower stalls. The fight and noise could be heard all around, but the campers and staff were grateful for the result. Another camper who drew my attention was an elderly man who was poised, dapper, and highly educated. He spoke at least 17 languages and spoke to me thoughtfully and intelligently about many subjects. One evening, I sat down with him on the hilltop at the camp as he explained the differences between Hungarian and other languages. As we spoke, the annoying woman walked by, and I mentally noticed I could not smell her this time. I took the opportunity to comment on how she had become the bane of the camp and had been wreaking havoc all week. Very quietly, the man said, "That's my wife." I was shocked and speechless. This was beyond belief, and I was as embarrassed as I could be for my comments. The old man looked at me a moment, and then turning his arm, held out his left hand. I stared a few moments until he pointed to a long number tattooed there. "We were both held in Nazi concentration camps," he explained. "She was once a concert pianist. She toured Europe, a lovely, talented, caring woman. But in the camp Ravensbrück, they cut away her brain a piece at a time without anesthesia. I was in Auschwitz. When I found her after the war, she was like this." We sat in silence, and I stared at his arm. After a bit, he said, "People say I should put her in a home, but I just can't do it. I remember her." Almost 30 years had passed without any improvement. As I sat thinking, my mind flashed on the camp shires in a large room with shire heads all around. They looked like the pictures I had seen of the so-called shires where Jews were gassed. I thought about the lines for the meals. I thought about the glazed look in her eye and her constant panic. Then there was this quiet man sitting by me on the hill. The old gentleman knew the talented pianist. He loved her with that enduring, sticky love the Bible calls loving kindness. So for a definition for trauma, I want to think about that in the mental health field, we're coming to realize that many, many people actually exhibit some signs of trauma. And I want to be careful about this because I don't want to take away from the significance of people that, like this lady, they're traumatized beyond belief. But it's estimated that maybe over 60% of Americans have some sort of trauma in their life. And the way I want to define trauma is that it anytime you experience significant disruption in your internal world can be traumatic. And the reason I say internal world is that we tend to judge trauma by what you see happens externally. And sometimes it may not look that significant on the external, but a cumulative effect of many small things and then one more thing can put a person into a state where they start exhibiting symptoms of having trauma. So the important thing is to remember is how did whatever happened affect the person internally? So if you look at your handout, I want you to remember what's on this paper probably more than anything else I have to say today. And I also want you to add a few things to it. So first of all, you have an incident or a stimulus that you perceive through your senses, and it becomes, you become aware of it in your mind, right? The effect of that moves from your head into your body, and you tend to tense up. So we're going around the circle here. We're down on the right-hand side. Your muscles tense up. That allows the production of adrenaline and cortisol to begin. So it's a process of how this happens. So once you have the production of adrenaline and cortisol, it moves into your bloodstream and is headed back to your brain. Okay? So the blood flow reaches the brain laden with a chemical cocktail, and the initial fear becomes reinforced. So whatever it was that freaked you out, when this cycle is completed, what the adrenaline wants to tell your brain is that what you were afraid of is really, really important. So then the tendency is to think into that and continue the process of this circular thing. So once you experience trauma, sometimes it can be really, really hard to get this process to stop, because it becomes a self-fulfilling feedback loop. Okay. Now, what I want you to pay attention to is at the top of the circle, I have that dark spot with a line drawn and it labeled a dam. Now, when you have the production of adrenaline and cortisol in your body, and it gets back to your brain and wants to reinforce the trauma, if you don't think into that, let's say the danger has subsided. Let's say you had a near-death experience, just like that, but you made it, all right? You're actually nothing wrong with you, but you almost, you know, if you'd have been a whisker over, you'd have been killed. The danger passed, but it takes time for that adrenaline to be depleted in your body. So when it comes back around to your brain and it wants to reinforce that fear, the tendency is to continue to think into the possibility that there's still danger or that something else is about to happen. So, if you don't think into it, you're going to experience pressure and stress in your head, heart, body, because your rational mind is saying the danger is past, everything's fine, life can go on. But the adrenaline in your system wants you to still be hyper alert, looking for more danger and all that kind of thing. And if your rational mind is strong enough, you'll endure that pressure in your head and your body for a period of time, and eventually that adrenaline will go down, the pressure will leave, and you'll be fine. So let's go down to the bottom of the page. Some of my stuff is going to overlap a little bit back and forth. But so you have, we have what we call our central nervous system, right? You got your brain, you got your spine, your spinal cord, you got nerves going out, your all your limbs. And under that system, we have an autonomic nervous system. Now, what that means is that built into your brain is survival instincts that you do not have control over. So I'm just going to do a little demonstration to show you that you have things that you cannot control. Okay? You ready? Yeah!
Nope.
Now, did you see what you... like that. And that's the most complex autonomic body response there is. It acts when you go forward like that. So, the autonomic nervous system is in charge of taking over control whenever we're in a traumatic situation. And when the autonomic nervous system senses danger, it kicks in what we call the sympathetic nervous system, which is the one that introduces adrenaline, cortisol. You probably heard of fight or flight or all that kind of thing. That is produced by the sympathetic nervous system. When we're not in the sympathetic nervous system and we're relaxed, we're in what we call the parasympathetic mood. Anyway, so much for that. So, let's go back again a little bit to think about what makes something traumatic. So, I touched just a little bit on previous life experiences. Suppose you have a young person that struggled with acceptance, bullying, and has maybe had a few difficult experiences that weren't that traumatic, but had some impact on them. And suppose you're in the middle of a severe struggle. Suppose a young guy just asked a girl out, he had his first date, but he's scared to death, he has no idea how it's going to go, and he's a little bit preoccupied, and he has doubts about himself to begin with. And just use my occupation, suppose he's out logging and he cuts a tree down and that whatever, something goes wrong and he ends up hurt, bad hurt, right? So he's taken to the hospital and he lays in the hospital a couple days and he's nervous before this happened. And now he don't have anything else to think about and he's laying there and his mind just starts going wild. You know, he starts thinking, you know, suppose, what's this all about? Maybe I'm not where I'm supposed to be in life. Maybe God's speaking to me, and on it goes. So part of the impact of that is the previous experiences that happened before the actual trauma that set him up to respond in certain ways. Also, the context of this present situation. Suppose you have a dangerous situation, and you know it's dangerous, and you prepare for it, and you do everything you're supposed to do in a dangerous situation, and something bad still happens. So I have a cousin, he's a farmer, married a farmer over here toward Harrisburg, and good farmer, good dad, successful family, and one Saturday morning they're out moving some calves. They put a calf in the skid loader bucket, and the one child's running the skid loader, and he's backing up. So the dad's like, hey, we're going to back up with this thing. All you children, you stay back so nothing happens. And it's a little bit dangerous. And the first thing you know, he turns around, and there's one of his children running over. Think about the impact of that and the destabilizing that, how destabilizing that could be to your confidence and your ability to navigate life. So, I mean, what all does that tell you? It tells you that life is not safe. It tells you that even if you prepare, bad things happen. It tells you that things happen in an instant. So you can be safe right now, but what about the next moment? And on it goes. And it's very easy to start believing, and in a sense it's true, that we're not safe. So, you know, I mentioned our daughter. You know, you can tell her she's safe all day long, but she has reasons to doubt that. And she'll say, well, you could die. How do you know? Like, we tell her, we go away today, we're going to be home tonight, because she was afraid we're not going to come back. She's like, how do I know? You could die. We said, no, we'll be back. No, you could have a wreck. Well, on and on it goes, and it's true. How do you live with that? You know, if you haven't experienced these things, you're innocent. But if you experience it, you're robbed of that innocence. And it, then what do? So when we're in this mode of trauma, there's some particular behaviors that happen, and one of them is anxiety. You know, I just told about, so the bad thing happened. How do we know it's not going to happen again? What's to keep me safe? You could wreck. How do I know you're going to come home? I can't promise you. I can't promise my daughter I'm going to come home tonight, as much as I want to. So there you have the setup for anxiety. What am I going to do? She's already lost two parents. What's she going to do? She already says, you know, what would have happened to me if you wouldn't have loved me? You know, well, suppose I'm taken away. So she worries. Is that understandable? It makes perfect sense to me, especially to a little child. So one thing I wanted to get into here before I go any farther is I talked a little bit about the effects of adrenaline on the brain. But our brain is made up of cells that we call neurons. And the way our brain cells communicate, there's lots of things we do not know. But this is supposed to represent a neuron. Okay, this is a neuron shaft. This is a neuron shaft. This is like the bulb, maybe they call it. And these hair-like things we call dendrites. And these dendrites produce neurochemicals. You may have heard of serotonin, different ones like that. And what happens is the dendrite will emit a neurochemical, and it kind of ripens like an egg on a flipping tube, and that egg is released, and these dendrites do not touch each other. In this space we call a synaptic cleft, all right? And that neurochemical floats across the synaptic cleft and is picked up by the next cell. Now, some of these neurochemicals are shape specific. Maybe they're a circle, maybe they're a square. And they have to fit in a receptor site on the other side that fits that neurochemical. And that's just the beginning of the complexity of a neuron. And there's a zillion things that can go wrong with a neuron. And when you start studying this stuff, all of a sudden, it's no wonder that some people have problems thinking. What you all of a sudden realize is it's a miracle that anybody even functions at all. Okay? So, what happens with a person who experiences trauma is that adrenaline hits the brain, and just like your body becomes rigid, your brain becomes rigid. Now, I'm making this oversimplified to the point it's almost poetic, but suppose these dendrites, you know, let's think of them as a swimmer, you know. They're emitting these chemicals, and they're swimming together like this. And the one side's collecting, one side might be emitting. Right? Suppose they become rigid when you're tense, just like your legs hardly want to move whenever you just come through something traumatic, right? Your brain's functioning the same way. So, when this happens, you may experience low or no self-awareness, low or no capacity to self-evaluate, no ability to self-regulate, low or no facility to establish goals and act consistently to obtain them, poor self-image, likely reacting to life rather than being intentional about what to do, self-centered, narcissistic. These symptoms can be a result of not being... Oh. So why does this happen in the psychological sense? So especially for kids, something really bad happens. And thankfully, probably most of you haven't experienced horrible things, but I see kids that are just, you know, one of the worst things is this thing of divorce and parents that aren't married and kids getting sent back and forth between homes and they're traumatized. Children were never designed for... to wake up and wonder where their dad is and wonder where their mom is. And we have fears in good homes. Can you imagine what it's like in a violent, unpredictable home? So, you know, one kid came in, his mom's like, I have no idea what's wrong with this boy. He's been a good boy. He's 8 years old. Now he's just throwing stuff and carrying on and tearing the house up and we need you to fix him. I was like, all right, you go out of the room. So she goes out, and I asked the little boy, I said, what's going on? He said, well, Mom and Dad's fighting. And he said, I don't know if Dad left. And he said, I don't know if he's coming back. And he said, I don't know if I'm ever going to see him again. And he said, she won't tell me a thing. He said, I have no clue what's happening. So he was just going nuts, right? So, you know, brought the mom back in. We talked about it and got some confirmation that he was going to be able to talk to his dad and got some things worked out a little bit. And he calmed down. Next week, come back, he's doing better, right? So that's trauma. And kids come in and I'll say, or even adults, and I'll say, one of my first questions is, have you ever experienced trauma? And they're like, no, I don't think so. And then my next question is, tell me about your family. Oh, I don't know. My dad, he left when I was 2 years old. And then Mom had a couple boyfriends and a stepdad. And I really don't have a dad. And then I tell them, I say, look, let me tell you about your trauma. And the scales start falling off their eyes. Because it's so normal, they don't even realize that it's abnormal. But it is abnormal. Kids were never designed to live in that. Anyway, so one of these symptoms is anxiety. And then we want to move to OCD. An obsessive compulsive disorder is a mental illness, okay? I don't know if any of you here believe in mental illness or not, but it's a thing. And obsessive compulsive disorder is a disorder of the brain as it tries to relate to anxiety. So the anxiety can get to a point where there's so much anxiety that your brain has what we call a coping mechanism that it will develop to help you deal with that anxiety. The ironic part is the coping mechanisms usually end up causing more pain than the real problem. So if any of you here have ever experienced obsessive compulsive disorder, it's more painful than the reality that your brain is trying to deal with. So, it's a disorder in the fact that your brain develops. Okay, let's suppose you experience trauma and it's painful. All right, suppose you're an 18-year-old, you just got your license, and you're driving your mom down the road, and you whip out your cell phone, and you're looking at it, and first thing you know, you're off the road, you hit a pole, your mom dies, and it's a horrible thing because you were on your phone, right? It's too painful to acknowledge. And that girl will go out and tell everybody she meets that asks her about it, that something went wrong with the steering on that car. And it may be 5 years from now, she may get to the point where she can acknowledge that, hey, you know what, I was on my phone. That wasn't a good thing. But in the meantime, her brain takes the... Because she can't face the painful reality, the brain will develop an alternative place to put the emotion. So, how many of you here have ever washed your hands too much? So, 80% of people that struggle with OCD have had at least one time in their life a hand-washing episode where they could not stop washing their hands. And, you know, you'll wash your hands and wash your hands. I did this when I was about 6 years old, till my hands were so chapped and bleeding and painful that I couldn't wash them anymore. And then finally I was able to stop. But that is a misplaced... it's something that your brain attaches... And it's usually something that's unknown. Who can prove that you don't have germs on your hands and who can't? So it can't hurt to wash them one more time, right? But the point is, usually there's something else bothering you in the back of your mind that you can't resolve. Suppose your parents aren't getting along. Suppose you're scared dad's going to leave. Suppose big brother's doing something he shouldn't. On and on the list goes. And you feel... Whether you know it or not, you can't solve the problem. And people ask me lots of times what I do in counseling, and whether I'm a Christian counselor or this or that or whatever, and how I tell people to live. And I don't do much of that because most of the people I work with are people that are relating to things that they cannot change. Their dad's an alcoholic. They were abused. They were in trauma. They were dead and brought back to life, and on the list goes. You can't change it. It happened. What are we going to do about it? That's where therapy comes in. So I'm not so much about right and wrong or what you should or should do, but rather I try to help people experience, identify, label, and talk about what they're feeling. And for some strange reason, it makes people feel better. So how many of you work out? Okay. Suppose, you know, these young guys are big and tough. Well, I can bench 200 pounds. Well, guess what? The first time they dump a 200-pound weight on you, you can't bench it. Okay? How do you get there? You break that 200-pound down in 25-pound weights, and you lift, 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 and you lift. And then next week you add another weight, and you lift, and you lift, and you lift. All right. Big, bad, terrible things happen to people. Their world comes crashing down on them. Their parents, somebody died. Somebody got killed. Whatever happens. Mom and dad got divorced. Terrible things. Dumped on you. Nothing you can do about it. You can't lift it. It's too big. What do you do? When you come to see me, we break it down into smaller pieces, and we lift it, and we lift it. You tell your story. You may tell your story 1,000 times. There's no rule. But what you're doing is it's like you're lifting that 25-pound weight over and over and over again. And eventually, if you lost a 16-year-old to a wreck, you can get to the point where that can be a part of your life. You can talk about it, and it doesn't destroy you every time you think about it. Because you've told that story and told that story, and you've lifted that weight and you've lifted that weight till you can carry it. It's become a part of you. So, time's getting away. Scrupulosity is a type of OCD, all right? And if you have scrupulosity, believe it or not, it is one of the most definable mental illness there is. There's a list of thoughts that people have that have scrupulosity. And you can go to the textbook, and I can read it out of you, and there's maybe 15 of them, and you might have 10 of them, but they're, everyone else that has scrupulosity thinks the same thing. So, a really bad thing has happened, all right? I'll just use myself for an example. When I was 19 years old, I was working in the woods cutting trees, and I had this really nasty tree to cut. It was leaning. It was this big boulder it was up against. And usually when you cut a tree off, you let it hinge, you know, and the tree hangs onto the stump, and it goes over, and everything's fine. Well, I knew this tree. It was leaning over that boulder so hard, I couldn't, the hinge was going to break off. So I made myself a plan. I had a place to run. I had everything figured out. And as soon as that tree started going, I beat it. And when I got to my safe place, I looked over my shoulder, and in that instant, that tree smacked me in the hip and it threw me over, and the chainsaw came down on top of my hand, and you can see my hand has that big scar there. Pretty near cut my hand off. So, I was 19 years old. I just started dating my wife. I was nervous as a cat. I was sure she was not going to continue this thing, and on and on and on. And I had doubts. I had always been a person. Well, let me back up. Somewhere along the line, when I was 12 years old, I got stuck on the unpardonable sin. And I convinced myself that I was going to hell, and there wasn't anything I could do about it. And I've talked to different people about it, and I didn't seem to get a lot of help. But when I was 17, I finally decided that there wasn't any many other options, and if that somebody could possibly forgive me, it was only going to be God. So I started my Christian life with the idea that even if God sent me to hell, I was going to serve him. So that's where I was with God. And then I have this accident. I get in the hospital, and I start just, my thinking just started going wild. I was sure that, you know, the doubts started coming back. Maybe you aren't right with God. Maybe God's speaking to you. Maybe this is judgment. Maybe you shouldn't be dating that girl. Maybe. And I just started thinking, I thought into the pressure, right? Like that. My dam is not very good, I'll tell you that. See, I still remember I was there, sweat just pouring off of me, and this African-American nurse came in and checked on me, and she's like, oh my, you so sweated up. She's like, I'll get something to help you. And she came in there with a big old gallon of baby powder. She says, sit up there. She just, I never knew baby powder felt so good, but it just like cooled me off. And so where am I going with this? Well, this is how anxiety feeds into scrupulosity and fear of God, and on it goes, because we want to know why things happen. And the first, if you're religious, Christian, doesn't matter what religion you are, they all do it. Some religions are even more fear-oriented than what we have. And immediately wonder, is God telling me something? And instead of just sitting with the anxiety and sitting with the pressure of not knowing, we want to think. And as soon as we start thinking, you know, if you're a doubtful person at all, the first thing you think about is, well, me, I'm not sure if I'm going to heaven anyway. So maybe God is really trying to tell me I'm going to hell. And then, well, why would that be? Oh, we're blasphemous. Oh, well, I took care of that. I covered all the bases. I've talked to everybody I can talk to. I've done what? Yeah, but remember when you was 12 years old, you did that thing, you know? Oh, I got to go make that right. So you go make that right, and you get about 5 minutes of relief, and it comes back, and all of a sudden you're like, well, now what could be about? What's causing this? I just feel so guilty. Well, you know, you was a bad kid, and I mean, you wasn't nice to your mom and dad all them years. I'll see, talk to mom and dad. And on it goes, and I'm telling you, it won't help you if you have scrupulosity. And you need a very wise person to sit with you and help you discern what is going on, because none of us here wanted to end up at the end of our life with things that we should have made right and didn't, and all that kind of thing. But it can be extremely painful. I mean, the anxiety level of fearing that you're going to hell and there's nothing you can do about it is just mind-blowing. It's horrendous, and it's cruel, and it's hard for me at times to not get angry at God for saying there's even such a place that exists. But maybe some people need that in their life to really shake them up, but some of us could do with a whole lot less fear. But if our scrupulosity is a result of trauma and lack of brain plasticity, by the way, that's what that's called whenever our neurons don't work right. It's called a lack of plasticity. Direct spiritual solutions will have little impact because our brains are not in a position to process spiritual truth due to the lack of brain plasticity. What we need to do to solve this is to quit fighting so much in our head, in our heart, but start fighting with our body and reduce the levels of adrenaline and cortisol. So, when I was in the thick of my anxieties, the only person that ever helped me was a person who was willing to help me relax. He says, you've got to relax. Let's relax, okay? So we started doing relaxation, and my adrenaline levels come down, and guess what? My brain started working a little better, and I could hang on to some truth that God has spoken in my life. But when your brain isn't working right, you can repent, you can believe that you're forgiven and have peace. It might last 5 seconds. It might last a minute. It might last a day. But if you have scrupulosity, it will come back. And the next moment you're relaxed, it'll come back, and it'll bring some friends with it, and it'll be a little bit worse. And the thing that you need to learn to do is learn to start fighting differently, not harder. Okay? And it looks like I'm out of time. So, I'm going to be here the rest of the day. If anyone wants to talk to me about this stuff, I'd be glad to talk. I probably would rather do that than sit in some other session. So, there you are.
Thank you for listening. All recordings from Reach 2022 are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. To purchase additional recordings from Reach or other Faith Builders events, visit us online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769.